Until Sunday, it was Jim Barnes who won the very first PGA Championship in 1916 and captured it again in 1919, who held the distinction of being the only golfer from England to win that major championship. That all changed, and did it ever, thanks to a riveting display of golf over his final 10 holes, punctuated by a thrilling 68-foot birdie putt on the 17th hole that propelled Aaron Rye, he of two gloves and covers on his irons, to his first major championship. Kelly Elbin here, along with Janice Self, our executive producer, welcoming you to this special episode of Musings on Golf as we recap the 108th PGA Championship at Aronimink Golf Club outside of Philadelphia. Shortly, you're going to hear my interview with Rex Hoggard of Golf Channel, who has now covered more than 100 major championships. Rex was on site at Aronimink. He has a lot of thoughts about what transpired over the 4 days there and about what makes Aaron Rye not only such a popular champion among his peers, but such a deserving PGA champion. Aaron Rye had won just once on the PGA Tour until he closed with that flourish on Sunday to become the first English golfer to have his name etched on the Wanamaker Trophy in 107 years.
Extremely, extremely proud. There's a lot of incredible and historic English players over those 100 years who have gone on to achieve incredible things and had phenomenal careers. But to win this event and to be a person that's the first one to have won it in such a long time from England is an amazing thing and something to be extremely proud of.
And he should be extremely proud. Those final 10 holes, playing those in 6 under par, the eagle on number 9, obviously that long putt on 17, but he just hit the ball so well off the tee, iron play, when it mattered the most. And that's what championship golf is really all about, is winning. And he won that. And you had, 22 players within 4 shots of the lead going to the final round. And as Rex Hoggard and I will discuss, it wasn't exactly like Aaron Rye's name was at the top of anyone thinking he would be the one who came through, but he did. It's also the first time that Europeans have won the first two major championships of the year, with Rory McIlroy winning at the Masters. So much to me, if you watched the 4 days of the PGA Championship at Aronimink, came down to the very traits that makes Aaron Rye such a good player. Accuracy, patience, discipline, all demanded of players to try to raise that Wanamaker Trophy. Aaron Rye was 4th in driving accuracy. He was 3rd in putting. And frankly, he was 1st in patience and discipline. And you can win a lot of golf tournaments like that. I also was struck by Aronimink Golf Club itself. I think there were a lot of people, and Rex and I get into this as well, who thought that you're going to see 15 under, 16 under, 17 under. And the PGA of America had something to do with keeping those scores low. They put some hole locations in some very, very tough spots. The players didn't like it, but you know what? That's a major championship. So be it. That's what you have to do. The rough was tough. You hit into it in some spots and you saw players just slashing the ball to get out of there. And sometimes the ball scooting into the rough on the other side. That's what major championship golf should be. I loved it. I thought it was great and very, very happy for Aaron Rye. We'll see what he does next month at the U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills on Long Island. You will hear my interview with Rex Hoggard right after these words from our good friends at William & Harry Golf and the Friars Golf Club. Also remind you to like us, to subscribe to Musings on Golf on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you go to enjoy your favorite podcasts. And of course, Musings on Golf has to be very, very high on that list. Right after these words, Rex Hoggard from Golf Channel as we recap the PGA Championship 2026. Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com. Is your golf life stuck in a bunker of country club hassles? Tired of the wait lists and the six-figure initiation fees? Well, at the Friars Golf Club, we take care of all of the hard work, planning exclusive trips and unforgettable rounds on top-rated courses, so all you have to do is show up, have fun, and make lifelong friendships on the first tee, the 19th hole, and far beyond. Our terrific 2026 lineup includes international destinations like Dubai and Scandinavia, plus top domestic resorts such as Sand Valley and Black Desert, and access to some great private clubs. Join the Friars Golf Club today. Email us at info@thefriars.com, the word musings in the subject line, to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. We invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience with the Friars Golf Club. He has covered a quarter century worth of PGA championships and more than 100 major championships in all. From serving our country to providing great perspectives about our game on Golf Channel, our special guest today has plenty of stories to share in this recap of what was a fascinating 108th PGA championship. So pleased to welcome Rex Hoggard to Musings on Golf. How you doing, Rex?
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I will say this, that when you sent me the email making me do the math, that was a wound that I didn't want to revisit. When you said it out loud, yeah, over 100 majors, 100. Quarter century. Yeah, that just means I'm old. That's all it means.
But that's a great honor. I mean, to be able to be on the front line, if you will, of that important moments in golf, it's a pretty cool feat.
It is. I had this conversation with my son. He's a senior in college right now, and he's sort of talking about wanting to get into golf. And now that he's sort of taken this deep dive and he's getting to know the history a little bit, when I have the conversation with him that, oh, you were at the 08 Open when Tiger did what he did. And I was walking with him on Saturday when he made the run. And then, of course, when he finishes up on Sunday and then the playoff on Monday. So it helps when I have him sort of whispering over my shoulder, like to remind you that, yes, it's really cool that I've had the opportunity to do that.
No question about it. And you had the opportunity to spend a week at Aronimink Golf Club outside of Philadelphia. And look, this is a special episode. We always recap the major championships. This one got delayed a couple of days for various reasons. So at least it's given me, Rex, a chance to sort of think a little bit more, and also to see the ratings for both CBS Sports and ESPN were really good coming out of the PGA Championship. CBS highest final round for their coverage of the PGA Championship in the past 5 years. Obviously, Aaron Rye's, man, the last 10 holes playing at 6 under par, the long putt, the 68-footer on 17. Okay, you were there for the week. I saw it on television along with Janice and many others. What were your takeaways, and I'm sure there are several, from the 2026 PGA Championship?
You know this better than anyone. When it comes to the PGA Championship, it's specifically Kerry Haig, the Chief Championships Officer for the PGA of America. He's a brilliant setup man. And he's a brilliant setup man because it seems like we never start talking about the golf course on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday going into the PGA Championship. For example, at the U.S. Open, you know we're going to spend a lot of time talking about how Shinnecock Hills is going to be set up. That's not the case when it comes to Kerry, because Kerry is brilliant at just letting the test be the test. He never tricks it up. This was a little bit different on a couple levels. You had some outspoken players, Rory McIlroy being at the front of that line, talking earlier in the week before the tournament started about it was on the shorter side. I think it's the shortest PGA Championship venue they've had in over a decade. And the rough wasn't probably what they wanted. When you get these Northeast venues with a May PGA Championship, sometimes the growing season isn't great because, as most people who live in Northeast know, it's been really cold, really snowy this winter. So there were some question marks. Would the golf course be set up in a way that allowed guys to go super low? And when you start predicting scores, and I was as guilty as the next talking head and media saying that I thought 16, 17 under par was going to be the winning score. I work with a stats guy who works with a lot of tour players. His name is Mark Horton, and he always gets it right. He's never wrong. He predicted 14 or 15 under par. When you actually saw the tests on Thursday morning and you saw how difficult and demanding it was, there's something that factored into that. It was on the cold side. The rough was probably a little bit thicker than players gave it credit for. I think it was going to be more penal than they gave it credit for. The wind was up, and Kerry Haig was able to protect the course with the greens, which is, that's the recipe for success on that course. So I love the idea that this dynamic that we spent the entire pre-tournament week talking about one thing, and it turned out to be the exact opposite. And I absolutely loved the idea of what that golf course was. When you look at the tests, it wasn't your normal major championship setup. It wasn't a ball striking contest, which is what we normally run into at almost every major, whether that's off the tee with length, from the fairway. We talk about the Masters being a second shot golf course all the time. That wasn't necessarily the case at Aronimink. It was you had to hit the ball straight, which is weird. We don't talk about that much in professional golf anymore. And you had to lag putt. I mean, not necessarily putt well, but you had to lag putt well because the greens were so demanding. And no one did that better than Aaron Rye.
I contend, and I'm really interested in your opinion. Again, I worked for the PGA of America for a dozen years, got to know you well at PGA Championships and Ryder Cups. Coming off of what was clearly a debacle at the Ryder Cup 2025 on Long Island, in a lot of ways, Rex, and certainly internally for the PGA of America, I mean, I think it cost the CEO his job. The president of the PGA has been muzzled and not even allowed to show up at their events for the past, well, the certainly for the PGA Championship. I felt like this was a win, if you will, for the PGA of America, because Rex, it didn't get to 16 or 17 under. It didn't feel like a another sort of PGA Tourish type of event. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's a very fair statement. When you look at, I should not do this. When you look at social media though, and you look at the comments, and it seemed like they were equally split between the golf course was too easy or the golf course was tricked up and too difficult. If you have a 50-50 split on that, you have landed exactly in the middle, probably exactly where Kerry Haig wants to be, that you never want to take it over the top. You never want to have the conversations like they've had at the US Open, at Shinnecock and some other venues where you just tricked it up too much and it was unplayable. You had some players hinting at that last week. You had some players suggesting maybe he'd taken it to the edge, but no one actually said the thing out loud that, oh yeah, they've lost the golf course. It's too much. I think it was a win for him. And you're right. Coming off Beth Page, I'm in the minority. I didn't think the only thing that was wrong with that particular Ryder Cup was the U.S. team. The U.S. team just didn't play well. And we could pick apart Keegan Bradley, the captain for the U.S. side. But I had no problem with what Beth Page was, because I think everybody going in should have known what it was. It was going to be that type of atmosphere. It was going to be rowdy and probably obscene and not what we're used to in golf. But that's what you signed up for when you went to Beth Page. This was a win, though.
Let's talk about this particular championship. You had a whopping 22 players within four shots of the lead going into that final round. Okay, a little hindsight. Looking back, does it make sense to you now that it would that it eventually was Aaron Rye who broke through? Did you have any sense of him at all as a guy? But does it now kind of make that disciplined, focused individual was the one who ultimately prevailed?
No, I'm not going to do that. I picked John Rahm to win on Saturday night. I'm not going to circle back around.
I know yes. You did. I know. Did you think of Aaron Rye at all? Was he in the mix whatsoever?
Not on Saturday night, no. And that was no disrespect to him. We only have 30 minutes to talk on the podcast on Saturday night. So as you pointed out, we had 22 guys to get to. And I'm pretty sure neither Ryan Lavner nor myself on live from probably the exact same thing with Brandel Chamblee and Todd Lewis and myself and the rest of the cast. Nope, we never got around to him because he'd never been in this situation before, never really contended in a major championship before. And it was the names around him that probably drowned out the noise. It's not as though Aaron Rye just ran away with this, even though the final score probably looks like that. But fact of the matter is John Rahm was right in the mix until the very end. Rory McIlroy was in the mix until the last two or three holes. And he can make an argument that if he plays all he needed to do was play the par fives marginally better, and he would have probably ended up forcing a playoff at the very least. Even Scottie Scheffler was in the conversation. You have every combination of Alex Smalley and Matty Schmid and everyone else that went down the leaderboard. So no, honestly, I would have never gotten to Aaron Rye. In retrospect, I think all of us have been able to put it together in our mind, because you can look at what he did well statistically. You can look at what that golf course demanded, asked of players, and he fit that bill. And also, I think you have to give Aaron credit for staying inside the bubble. And that's got to be so difficult, but for someone who had never been there before and to execute some of the shots that he executed coming down the stretch, I think the bunker shot on 16 is the one that blows me away still, because even as caddy said, I've never seen him hit that shot. And to be able to do that under the most intense pressure, I can't give enough kudos and enough respect to that.
Do you have a story about him, Rex, any of having gotten to know him maybe a little bit? Because the universal kind of admiration and if good feeling for this guy, whether guys on the Europeans, whether Americans, they were very happy that this was the guy who won the PGA Championship. Anything personal you can add?
Everyone did. I think Rory said it best. There wasn't a person on property at Aronimink that wasn't happy for Aaron Rye. You were upset maybe that you didn't win, but you had to have a tremendous amount of respect. I love the workmanship. He's one of those guys that just loves the journey almost more than he loves the destination, is the way I would say it. I think Scottie Scheffler probably has a little bit of that, where it's the work. It's trying to put yourself in these positions and knowing that, yes, I put in the work, I should be able to pull this off. Those things I respect, but I do. 2020, he was a rookie on the PGA Tour, had just come from the Korn Ferry Tour. He was playing the RSM Classic. And I usually do this in the fall when the new class comes over from the Korn Ferry Tour, or the European Tour, just try to get to know one or two players going into the season. So I did sit down and do an interview with him that week. And I think he was shocked that I wanted to have a conversation with him. But I remember walking away from that interview thinking to myself, yeah, he ain't gonna make it. Because to be a PGA Tour player, to be a winner on the PGA Tour, to be a major championship winner, you have to be mean. You got to be a little bit of a jerk. And there was absolutely none of that there. There was no show me. There was no conceit. There was no part of him that made it sound like, that. Yes, of course, I'm where I should be. I mean, there was nothing if not just question marks that he probably didn't even think that he belonged on the PGA Tour at that point. And it's so refreshing to see someone like not just make it on the PGA Tour, and he has, but now win a major championship. That's cool.
He is a unicorn of sorts that way, isn't he? To your point, Rex, and you're out there a lot more than I am, obviously, but I don't, you see guys who have that edge. They do, whether it's whether it's Rory, certainly, a DeChambeau, Brooks, guys like that. They've all got that little bit of something on the shoulder, but this guy, he's been consistent from what I understand, as you said, all the way through. He hasn't changed at all.
I think so. I think Rory's a great example, because there was a knock earlier in Rory's career that some people thought maybe he was too nice, that he wasn't going to go on this run and win the Grand Slam and do what he's ended up doing. And it turns out that's not the case. He likes to be the guy at the top of the mountain. He's proved it, if nothing, then over the last year after he won the Masters to complete that Grand Slam. And I think all of them have something in their DNA that really drives them to show off. They love being in the arena. Even the players that haven't won or haven't accomplished much on the PGA Tour, they love being able to stand out in the middle of a fairway and know that, no, I'm going to show people I can execute this shot. I went back to the idea of Matt Fitzpatrick on Sunday, the Zurich Classic a few weeks ago, when he's playing with his brother and he's probably wants to execute that shot on the 72nd hole. If you remember, it was a really difficult bunker shot. A really long, like one of the most difficult shots anybody in golf, even the best players are going to struggle. And just the way he walked into that bunker and executed that shot and his body language after him, that's the ultimate show off. And I say that with nothing but respect, because these are the best at what they do. And you have to have that element to go out and not just execute the shot, but be able to practice it enough to know time and time again that, no, I've got that. You never got the sense that that was Aaron Rye. Even now, you don't get that sense. The idea that he talked about playing against his wife, who is a professional. She plays on the European Tour, the Ladies European Tour. And how much do you guys play? Quite a bit. Do you have matches? Yes, quite a bit. Who wins more? The idea being that if he was going to be polite, he said usually it's a fair trade. Nope. He admitted she wins more than I do.
And I have to imagine that European Ryder Cup captain Luke Donald is smiling as well. He's got one more piece for the arsenal that has been the European team in Aaron Rye, and looking ahead to 27 at Adair Manor in Ireland, could be that he's the newest addition to the team.
Could be. I mean, the way this team is shaping up, the European team after the last two Ryder Cups, I just think at this point, he's just reloading. It really doesn't matter what names. I think Luke Donald has figured out the recipe, and you're going back to Europe or the United States, hasn't had any success in decades. I would argue I've been to Adair Manor where they're going to play the Ryder Cup next year in Ireland. It's when I went, I was told it was their version of Augusta. I didn't particularly believe that because everyone says that about their golf course, but it's very Augusta-like by the size of the fairways and the sloping greens and the second shots and how demanding it is. I wouldn't say it's a great fit for Aaron Rye, but I can still see him being a contributor to that team because he's not going to go anywhere. He's proven that he's a consistent player.
They were so pleased to be joined by Rex Hoggard, senior writer for Golf Channel and one half of the very popular Golf Channel podcast with Rex and Lav, along with Ryan Lavner. You guys have a lot of fun together, it looks like, and you stay super busy. I mean, you put those podcasts out a lot. That's a big part of that ongoing communication from Golf Channel on the podcast world, right?
We do. We enjoy it. We've been doing it for quite a while now, and I think we've grown into our voices and our relationship on the pod, and we try to have fun. I think that's probably the bigger deal. We're going to make fun of each other. We're going to have we're not going to take each other too seriously. I think that's the most important part. The pods have become most interesting at the biggest events, so at the majors, the Players' Championship, the Ryder Cup, and President's Cup, because we're doing mini pods after each round. And the goal, and I was laughing with the folks from Live From set about this, we want to beat Live From. We want to get to air on YouTube Live before they do and make people make choices. We're not trying to take any audience away from Live From. Of course not. That's it. But it is a new element to the job. It's something that I don't think he and I anticipated when we started it about 10 years ago.
Also, you have a great story in regards to something that's just over your right shoulder right now, an Emmy Award.
Yeah.
As part of the NBC sports team at the 2024 games covering golf in Paris, having to do with Mr. Lavner, please tell.
Yes, I'm very proud to have won the Emmy. It's not anything I ever anticipated I was going to be able to do in my career. And Lav, what he does mostly, he does the pod with me, but what he really loves to do more so than doing the pod is doing features. And he's done some brilliant features over the course of his career. And a few years ago, he won an Emmy for one of those features. And he's really proud of that Emmy. Anybody that's ever seen his live shot will see the Emmy in the background. And we tease him all the time. So last year, right about this time, because I think this is Emmy season, if I'm not mistaken, I was at Colonial. And he had called me and he was nominated for another Emmy. And he and his wife went to New York City and attended the ceremony and he didn't win. And so he calls me on his way home and he's pretty bummed. And I kind of felt bad for him. Like I can imagine, like, yeah, that's no fun. I'm not quite sure. We talk about players having conceit. I think that's a level of conceit that, yes, I'm going to go to New York because I knew I'm going to win is part of the conversation as well. Right. But I felt bad for him and I went to sleep that night and woke up the next morning and I had gotten an email from, at the time, the executive producer at Golf Channel, Molly Solomon. And we had won for our coverage, and we, the Rural We, NBC Sports, Golf Channel, for our coverage of all of the Olympics, just not golf. So I was in a group, but again, very, very proud, but I've never wanted to send a text message so bad in my life. It's still stinging that you didn't win your Emmy, but you're never going to believe this.
And as I said to you before we went on, for every loser, there is a winner, Ryan Lavner, in this case, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And never miss an opportunity to rub that in.
Great story. You mentioned Jon Rahm. There were a lot of interesting storylines. Justin Thomas, who'd had back surgery last year with that really compelling last few holes, in particular the putt he made for par on 18 for 65 to finish at 5 under. Talk a little bit, please, your thoughts about Jon Rahm, who seems to have that mindset back. At least he seems that way. Justin Thomas and anybody else who stood out. To your point earlier, you had Matty Schmid, you had Alex Smalley. It was a most interesting cast of characters down the stretch there on Sunday, Rex.
I think how eclectic the leaderboard was is, again, a testament to what Kerry Haig and that golf course demanded, because it's not one type of player. A lot of times we get to some of these venues and you're going to have one type of player that really has a chance. I would say Quail Hollow last year, and I have a lot of respect for Quail Hollow as a major championship venue, but it identifies a very specific kind of player. And normally those players are Rory McIlroy, Scottie Scheffler, Jon Rahm. A couple of those players stood out to me. JT, Justin Thomas, is atop that list. Having gone through offseason back surgery, sort of made his way back in the spring. I think Bay Hill was his first start back. There's a lot of uncertainty there. I think it's natural. If you're a player, my guess is Will Zalatoris continues to deal with that same uncertainty. If you are an athlete at that level and you go under the surgeon's knife, you have no idea what's going to happen. You have a lot of people around you that can convince you that, yes, this is the right thing to do and you can work your way out of it, but you're still always going to have doubts. And the fact that he has made steady progress since he came back playing hard golf courses, it's not as though he's showing up playing the easy golf right. courses. And this was an opportunity, I think, for him probably to prove something, not to us, not to the media or the fans, but to himself, that he probably knew in the back of his mind. He finished up about 3 hours before the leaders. He probably knew that, yeah, this isn't going to get it done, but it's a huge springboard for him. So I can't wait to see what he does in the final two majors of the year. John Rahm is probably the most fascinating case study, because you pointed out, I think, twofold here. One, he talked about this at the Masters, that he said he didn't play particularly well at the Masters, finished middle of the pack. And he said he found something in his major championship preparation that he felt like he was doing wrong. He was going to tinker it. And so we asked him about that on Sunday at Aronimink, and he didn't get into specifics. He said it's something that you probably wouldn't even notice. I think whatever that was, it either physical or mental, or maybe both, it gave him some sort of confidence that probably hadn't been there before. And in a weird way, what's going on with LIV Golf and the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia pulling its funding at the end of this year, and the uncertainty that goes into that, has maybe freed him up. There's probably an epiphany there that whatever's going to happen is going to happen. I'm sure there's a lot of guys who are playing LIV Golf right now that have a lot of anxiety about what their future holds. It seems as if John's just okay with his plight, whatever it might be.
Let's go off on that that road just for a bit, that LIV Golf road. Talk about them looking to find new funding. Also talk about them, and quite a bit of perhaps declaring bankruptcy in the United States. What do you see? What's do you have a sense at all, Rex Hoggard, of where this whole LIV Golf thing ends up? Do they have a 2027 season? Do they have any length to them beyond that, if they even get there?
I think they do. I think there's a window here. And I had a chance to spend a little bit of time with an executive from LIV last week at the PGA Championship. And the conversation went from, I think in my reporting, I had said that essentially they have to find their version of SSG. SSG is the group, the private equity group that invested in the PGA Tour. And I think to a certain degree, that's correct, but they're thinking a little bit more long-term. So if they can pull off this funding, and that's a big if, because you have to convince people with a lot of money and people who are smart about their money that this is a good investment. And up to this point, it hasn't. We know that they haven't been profitable up to this point. However, you and I both know there's a lot of really rich people that love to be involved in golf. So I'm not going to dismiss this. I'm not going to write them off. I know that's been the easy thing to do, at least on social media, is to write LIV Golf after this season. I don't think that's either fair or accurate. I think there's smart people involved here and they can figure out something. Now, what that looks like, I'm still a little unsure. My guess is it's certainly not going to be $20 to $30 million purses, what we've come to expect from LIV Golf. I don't think that's sustainable at all. It's probably also not going to be 14 events the way the calendar is structured right now. My guess is they lean into where they've had success, and that's internationally, not so much in the United States, but you look at venues, their event in Adelaide, their event in South Africa, their event in the UK, they have found success internationally. So my guess is they lean into that. I guess the big unknown is, we know, for example, John Rahm is signed to a multi-year deal, and they have to find a way to continue to pay that deal. There's payments involved there. So there's a lot of moving parts. We will know something for the end of the year. That's sort of the beauty of this. It's going to happen fast one way or the other.
Rex, this has been such a great interview so far. I'll tell you what, let's take a short break, hear from our friends at William & Harry Golf, and then we'll get right back to more of our PGA Championship recap. At William & Harry Golf, comfort meets purpose. Through their care campaign, William & Harry is partnering with charities to give back, donating a portion of every qualifying sale to support your cause. Enhance your next fundraiser with William & Harry customized golf shoes, auction packages, or exclusive giveaways. Crafted from fine deerskin, calfskin, and exotic leathers, William & Harry golf shoes offer all-day comfort from the course to the clubhouse in vibrant, eye-catching colors. Learn more at williamandharry.com or email info@williamandharry.com. William & Harry, style with a mission. All right, Rex, now back to the major championship trail. We go to Shinnecock Hills next month on Long Island. Scotty Scheffler once again will be trying to do what Rory accomplished last year with the career Grand Slam. What do you think of Shinnecock Hills in terms of that setup, how that may favor Rory McIlroy or John Rahm or Scotty Scheffler? Is there someone that stands out or a type of player who, in your opinion, should have success there?
I mean, Scotty Scheffler is the one I would lean into. We can sit here and try to pick apart what's wrong with Scotty Scheffler's game, and I think that's always silly when you consider what he's actually done this season. We ran a stat the week of the PGA Championship on Live From that it was essentially comparing his season to that point to his season to the same point last year. And he's essentially done the exact same thing. He had won once going into the PGA Championship. He had six or seven top five finishes. He had been close. The exact same thing this season. So the conversation about what's wrong with Scotty Scheffler always makes me giggle a little bit, because statistically, you would really have to take a deep dive to try to figure it out. I guess you can find maybe a hole in the armor on Thursdays. Maybe the putting isn't quite what he wants it to be. His proximity to the hole isn't quite what it has been in the past, but you're talking about percentages here. It seems like every other major stat is the same as last year. Sometime golf just happens. And I heard a great interview at the beginning of this year with Nelly Korda, coming off of her season last year, where very similar, she played well. It's not as though she was missing cuts every single week, but she didn't get it done. She didn't get that win. And essentially she was asked why. And you just sort of shrug, like, man, sometimes golf happens. There's a lot of good people that play professional golf for a living. And my guess is, in his honest moments, that's what Scotty says to himself, that, look, I'm one of many guys who want to come out here and win. However, that being said, he can complete the career Grand Slam at the U.S. Open. I think that's important in the back of his mind. And everything we know about that golf course is going to favor a player like Scotty Scheffler, a player who hits it a long way and a player who can control his wedge shots.
You said something interesting. I agree. When you were talking about that golf gets in the way, I was thinking of Cameron Young and how close he had been, right? Mm-hmm. And had played well in final rounds, but just hadn't won. You look at the Open Championship from a few years ago, and he was right there with Cam Smith. Golf happens, and then all of a sudden, what happens? He wins in Greensboro last year, and the floodgates kind of open. He ends up now, you know, as the Players' Champion. There are, Rex, so many good players that even if you're playing well, it doesn't guarantee by any means a victory.
No, and you can make the argument, and this is a stupid sports radio thing that we do sometimes on the podcast. Did Aaron Rye win last week, or did someone else lose it? I think Aaron Rye won. And I think nine times out of 10 on the PGA Tour, you can say the same thing. Now, certainly we end up with situations where a player has a big lead going in the last couple of holes and makes some, you know, mistakes that you just can't wrap your mind around. That happens. I'm not saying that that's not part of the game, but I would argue more times than not, you have a player like a Cam Young that just plays better than everyone that week, and it doesn't matter what you bring to the table.
Yeah, exactly. Having a terrific time talking with Rex Hoggard here on Musings on Golf. Rex Hoggard, before there was Golf Week, where you worked a lot of media centers typing away, before there was Rex Hoggard that we know on Golf Channel, there was Rex Hoggard in the Marines, and you'll always be a Marine. You served our country, and thank you, from 1986 to 1990. For you, what was the calling? Why the Marines? Why the calling to serve our nation the way you did?
I think at the time, I didn't understand the calling. Like, I was a 16, 17-year-old guy. I was 17, actually, because that's why I joined the Marines. I didn't quite understand what the calling was, but it was, in retrospect, it was wanting to be a part of something bigger than me, not having much interest in college, not having much interest in following my dad. My dad was a firefighter. My brother was a firefighter. I didn't have any interest in that. But I think once I made it through boot camp, once you got out in the fleet, I was a military police officer. Once I spent a year or two doing it, I quickly understood what it meant. That not only was I part of something bigger than myself, but I was also part of something that I could be proud of for the rest of my life. And I think when I look back, it's weird to say this, but I'm nowhere near, I don't accomplish anything that I've accomplished in my life if it's not for the Marines. I know that.
Did you have a built-in discipline from your dad, from your parents before you became a Marine?
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah, no, no. I think going in, I knew, I guess I to answer that a different way. I knew that I would have to adjust. I grew up surfing and playing golf as well, but I mean, surfing was my first love.
Where did you grow up?
Not far from where I live right now. So I grew up in Florida, Central Florida, over by Cocoa
Yeah.
Beach, a little town called Titusville. My
Sure.
dad worked at the Kennedy Space Center. And like, no, I was not. I wasn't a good student. None of that. So I knew going in that it was going to be a commitment, and I was smart enough to understand that just keep your head down. Make it through boot camp, and if they don't learn your name, the drill instructors is what I was told, that you've done a good job. And I made it up until the very last week. It was unfortunate.
How did the opportunity then to work in golf come along? You were with Golf Week as a reporter, a writer, a columnist for quite a number of years. How did that come along? And then how did it get to transition to in front of the camera? So instead of typing away, now you're in front of the camera. Give it both cases, please.
I still type away. I just don't do it enough, at least for my
True.
editor, Mercer
Yeah.
Baggs at golfchannel.com. But I do still type away sometimes. I went when I got out of the Marines. I went to college and got a journalism degree and started working at the Orlando Sentinel here in Florida. And the golf writer at the time, and you'll know this name, is the late Jeff Babineaux. He was the golf writer.
He was the sweetest of guys.
He was the
The
best.
best.
And to have an opportunity to learn under him, and he took me out. Actually, my very first golf tournament was Disney in 1996. And if you remember the sort of time frame, that was Tiger Woods' first start at Disney, kind of became the legacy. He wasn't quite Tiger Woods that, but my job that Babs had me do was essentially just follow around and write about everything that Tiger Woods did. I did not know that I would have a career doing exactly that, that I started that day doing exactly what I would do for the rest of my life. But long story short, Jeff ended up going to Golf Week magazine. He became the editor. I kind of took over him for a couple of years at the Sentinel as a golf writer. And then he ended up hiring me. And I was at Golf Week for about 10 years. Before 2009, another friend of mine, Jay Coffin, he and I had gone to college together at UCF. We'd worked at Golf Week together. He was the editor of golfchannel.com, and he needed a beat writer. And so someone who could cover the tour. And he hired me. And the transition to TV has been slow, and thankfully. So it's funny. It's 17 years now. And I still feel like, and I was having this conversation with a producer, and you'll love this. I still don't understand how to exactly read a rundown because I had to admit in front of a whole group of people that someone was asking, like, well, what don't you get about this? And I sort of held up the rundown and I go, until about 2 weeks ago, I didn't know what SOT was. And that's sound on tape. But when it's in the rundown, you have to understand that, okay, you have to stop talking then. And literally, I was 16 years in before I learned that. So I can only imagine the things I still don't know.
Get a little personal here for a second. I was so fortunate to have Bob Bupka as a mentor to me, and Bob was my co-host on Musings on Golf and a friend to so many. We lost Bob last year to congestive heart failure and some other things. And you talked about Jeff Babineaux, and Jeff Babineaux was a wonderful person. And whereas Bob was able to live a pretty full life, Jeff's life was cut far too short. Give our listeners a sense of who Jeff Babineaux was, why he mattered in the world of golf, and the legacy he leaves behind.
He would, since we've had the conversation about Aaron Rye, in my mind, he was the Aaron Rye of golf writers. And by that, I say it with all due respect, but I mean, the craft meant the world to him and how you did the craft and doing it the right way. I can't tell you how lucky I was to have not just Jeff Babineaux, but Jeff Ruud, who was a columnist at Golf Week at the time, because those two were the absolute perfect mentors, I would say, to go into the business, to be a young reporter just starting to cover the PGA Tour, because Jeff Babineaux made you do the job the right way. I mentioned 2008 in the US Open. And at the time, Golf Week, we had a lot of pages to fill and not a lot of time to fill it on Sunday night. And so at that 2008 Open, I was doing a feature on a swing coach named Jamie Mulligan, who now has become a staple on the PGA Tour. But he lives in San Diego. He loves to surf. Like, he was riding a skateboard through the golf course that week. It was like one of those stories that I just love to write, but I needed to get it done early. And so I remember asking my boss at the time, can I stay in my hotel room on Saturday of that US Open and just write? And he was like, yes, of course, just write well. And I remember Jeff calling me constantly that afternoon, like, what, why aren't you here? You need to be here. And being so aggravated that he would not leave me alone, I finally just slammed my laptop down and went to the golf course. And if you remember what Tiger Woods did that afternoon,
Yep.
I can look back and be like, okay, he talked me into doing the right thing. And that's just the perfect example of way he was always that angel on my shoulder that was making me do the job the right way. And you're right, we lost him way too early, and it was a shock. I think all of us are still even dealing with it. They did a great tribute to him at the Masters. He was the PGA of America Lifetime Journalism Achievement Award winner, and at the dinner, which is at Wednesday night at the Masters, the Golf Writers Dinner, he was given the award, and it was probably one of the most emotional nights I've had in a long time.
We've got a few minutes left with Rex Hoggard of Golf Channel. Hey, Rex, PGA Tour, you know, we talked a little bit about LIV Golf, but the PGA Tour and the stamp that Brian Rolapp is trying to put on where the PGA Tour is going. What did I see? Something of maybe as many as, 14 or 16 signature events maybe coming with fields of 120 players. Is that what you see where you're reporting people you're talking to? Is that what we're likely to see starting in 2027 on what will be a very new look to the PGA Tour?
I think that's what Brian Rolapp wants, and he wants to get to it quick. And there's kind of a couple different elements to this. And once you understand, once I started to understand why he was going in this direction and why he needed to get there quick, essentially, he needs to get a new product, a product that he can convince the TV partners is better than the old product. And that's, in his mind, is what you just described, essentially. And he needs to get it there quick, because essentially golf is going to be competing with Major League Baseball for its slice of the media rights pie. And once you break it down, that if you look at the media rights pie, it's X amount of dollars. And right now, the NFL has about half of that, which should be no shock to anyone. They're going after doubling that. And so what's going to be left is going to be very, very slim pickings for everyone involved. And so it's incumbent on every league, specifically the PGA Tour in this room, to get a good product, a better product to market, and to do it quickly and beat everyone else. That being said, I think right now what he wants is still a little bit up in the air. I think what you just described is perfect. If you have 14, I don't even know if you should call them signature events anymore. They're just events, and then you have the playoffs and the major championships, and that's the season. That sounds, in theory, like a good idea. I like the field sizes. I like the fact it would have cuts. I like the idea you get the best players together more often. Yeah. All of these things make sense, but you and I both were just talking about the schedule. And the schedule right now is already too condensed for many of the top players. You have top players missing events. Scottie Scheffler didn't play at Quail Hollow. Rory McIlroy didn't play at Hilton Head. You can keep going down the road of this conversation. So it's going to be a tough sell for Brian. And I will say there was a player meeting. It would have been 3 weeks ago now at Quail Hollow during the tournament, during the Truist Championship. And he sort of laid out the general terms of what he's trying to do. And I think most people are on board, but it's still up in the air. He has set a soft deadline, and we know he wants something decided by the policy board meeting that will come in June, the week after the U.S. Open at the Travelers Championship. But it's still a bit of an unknown.
Is he moving, in your opinion, too quickly, or is he, as you're saying, moving at the pace that he needs to get something done? Is this an intentional thing, right?
It's very intentional, and I don't think he's moving too quickly. If the end goal here is to get a better product to market and do it faster than anyone else, you can understand why. And once that was sort of laid out and explained, and let's keep in mind, there's a reason why Brian Rolapp was hired away from the NFL. He was essentially in charge of all of their media rights negotiations. So he was hired with a very specific purpose in mind as far as it applies to the PGA Tour. Golf doesn't move quickly, though. You and I both know that. It moves at its own pace. And in this particular case, there's probably a lot of anxiety, not just among regular PGA Tour members, but even PGA Tour players who are on the policy board, who will make this decision that you never really know if these are going to be what's best for the tour long term. So there's sort of a convergence there between wanting to wait things out and to see exactly what's going to happen. And probably the news that the Public Investment Fund was pulling its funding at the end of this year doesn't help Brian's argument, because I think a lot of players will look around and be like, what are we afraid of now? The irrational threat has essentially gone away. So he is in a tough spot.
He's hired, I would think, to put that stake in the ground, to have something that he can, you know, show as his shiny product. Because let's face it, Roger Goodell can't be the commissioner of the National Football League forever. It would seem like Brian Rolapp being able to have success, if that's what ends up happening with the PGA Tour, could then be a bridge, Rex Hoggard, to him going back and ultimately becoming the commissioner of the National Football League.
Yeah, I think it was interesting when he was first hired, and it was right last year, right about this time. And when I spoke with people from the NFL and executives from the NFL, there is a different dynamic in that organization than what you see certainly on the PGA Tour. The idea that they don't really hire from within, like they don't value institutional knowledge the way the PGA Tour certainly has in the past. And if you look at the success of the PGA Tour, I'm not quite sure you can debate that theory. But the idea is that if you want to move up, you probably have to come from outside. You have to be pulled in. So, yes, I think if you start connecting dots, the idea that the current commissioner of the NFL probably is only going to be around Roger Goodell for another 4 or 5 years, the idea that Brian Rolapp could leave his stamp on the PGA Tour, make it better. Make it a more secure business, make it a more profitable business, and then circle back around and go back to the NFL. I think that's a pretty easy argument to make.
Rex, let's go back, kind of peer into your crystal ball, if you will. You mentioned about Scottie Scheffler feeling like he's the guy with the edge going into Shinnecock. Is Scottie your pick for the U.S. Open at Shinnecock? And then also the Open Championship returns to Royal Birkdale. It's the 11th time it's going to be there. Last time it was there was 2017. Jordan Spieth won. Give me your pick. Give me that crystal ball for Shinnecock in June and Royal Birkdale in July.
Shinnecock's pretty straightforward for me. Again, if you look at statistically the winners, there's a lot of history at Shinnecock. You have to I don't like to gamble because I'm not very good at it, but my guess is Vegas can make a really good argument that Scottie Scheffler should be the clear favorite. Not by a mile. I don't think maybe last year at this time, we would have been having a little bit different conversation about how much of a favorite he was going to be. But looking what happened at Aronimink, I can see a group of four or five or six guys lumped all together, maybe starting with Scottie and going to Rory. I think John Rahm sort of breaking out of that major championship funk will be interesting. Cam Young has just had a phenomenal season. So all of those guys sort of have that prototypical game that you would want at Shinnecock. But yeah, I put Scottie at the top of the list. The Open Championship is always impossible. I mean, you and I both know, you just don't know what we're going to get. You start hearing rumors right about now that either the golf course is really dry or it's been a wet summer over there and it's going to be green and lush. And that sort of identifies two vastly different players. And then you also factor in that there's 14-hour tee time spreads. Like anything can happen between teeing off in the morning and teeing off late in the afternoon. But you go back to some of the other players. You mentioned Jordan Spieth going back there. I think Jordan Spieth has found an element to his game that had been missing. So that'll be fun to sort of watch him go back. And there's a lot of young players, I think, that could certainly step up and make a statement.
What's it like for you as far as being on the road? How many events will you cover in 2026? And certainly, with, as you mentioned about the condensed schedule, a lot of players, you know, taking time off. You've got a lot of big events in a very tight period of time. When does your season get started in terms of you being on the road? And when does it, do you have some breaks here and there? And then when does it wind down?
I don't know. We don't have breaks. And this goes back to the conversation about condensing the schedule and making them all big events, because I'm not quite sure. And I mean, he's not worried about what the media wants to do, but I'm not quite sure if you're going to get full participation from the top players, which is what you do. Right now, the schedule probably starts somewhere around American Express, somewhere early in the season. And with obviously the two Hawaiian events going away, that's going to condense it even more. Normally it's about 25 to 30 events. It's a little bit more now because the studios, Golf Channel Studios, are up in Connecticut. So you probably have to go up there a half dozen times over the course of the year to host some shows. So that adds a little bit to it, but it doesn't really get busy as far as tournament schedules go until you get to Florida. And then it's pretty hot and heavy from the time you get to Florida to the time you come back from the Open Championship. And then you get a bit of a breather. There's probably a 3 or 4 week stretch before you get to the playoffs. But yeah, it's pretty busy from Bay Hill on.
Memorial Day is coming up, and you being a Marine, and obviously Memorial Day means, you know, the barbecues and the fun and the whatever it might be, but the real meaning behind Memorial Day is one I'm sure that you can relate to. What does Memorial Day mean to you, Rex Hoggard, Marine, American? What does it mean?
Well, I'm always on the road, so I'm either traveling or staying in a hotel. So normally I don't get a chance to celebrate it like I wish I could, which would be at home. Doing barbecue is what I would really want to do. But it means the world. And I've had an opportunity, and you know this, Lieutenant Colonel Dan Rooney, he's an Air Force pilot. He started the Folds of Honor. I think you would have been there at that PGA Championship. Jeff Babbitt, I would just mention, wrote about the Folds of Honor. I've been lucky enough to become involved with Folds. Dan has sort of invited me in and allowed me to do a lot. And so right around that time, he usually has an event, which either at his course in Tulsa or there's a new course in Michigan where he sort of honors the mission that Folds of Honor is on, his mission, all of us who are involved with the Folds of Honor. And it's an unbelievably special place. Like, I can't, it's, I get emotional just talking about it, being around those people and what he does by providing, if you don't know Folds of Honor, they provide scholarships for the children of lost military members. And now it's gone to first responders as well. And the work that he has done and to be involved with that is just, it gives me so much joy and to have the opportunity and the honor to be involved.
Sarah Bush, who is a big part of Folds of Honor, was our guest leading into the PGA Championship. 73,000 scholarships have been awarded to those children, family members whose moms or dads were killed or injured. And as you said, it's expanded to first responders. I would be remiss before we go. We talk a lot about off course, what's going on with LIV Golf, what's the PGA Tour going to look like and so forth. But for me, the most honest and most human off-course moment of the year was the interview that you had with Gary Woodland in early March. And I wonder if you could explain how and why that interview came to be and what Gary felt like he had to tell people. And then, frankly, the remarkable, you know, what happened since with him winning. How did that come to be where he really bared his soul in a lot of ways, Rex?
Gary Woodland, who is an ambassador for Folds of Honor, by the way, and that's probably part of the connection. When you talk about how it happened, his team reached out to Golf Channel and he wanted to do this interview. And luckily, he and I have a relationship that goes back a lot of years. He's an amazing player, but he's an even better person. Anybody that's ever met Gary Woodland will tell you he's just one of the most genuine guys on the PGA Tour. And I knew he was struggling since he'd had brain surgery and there was a lot going on there, because it seems like every time I do an interview with him, as soon as the recorder went off, he always asked, like, how you feeling? You doing all right? And he would be like, no, not great. Never got into details, didn't know. So I think I got a call, it was Friday at Bay Hill Week, that he wanted to sit down Monday, the following Monday, which at the Players Championship at TPC Sawgrass. And so went up early, set everything up. Mark Steinberg, his manager, came into the room first and sort of just outlined everything. Told us what he wanted to talk about and the PTSD that he was dealing with and how it was impacting him both on and off the golf course. Stunned. I didn't know any of that was going to be part of it. And I remember Gary walking up the stairs. It was sort of in this building at TPC Sawgrass, and he was already emotional. And I remember speaking with Gary briefly before we sat down and started getting ready for the interview. And I've never said this to anyone else, and I'm sure I'll never say it again in my career. It's not a great idea to do this as a journalist, but I asked him, are you sure you want to do this? Because it was, in my mind, it was only going to make things more difficult, because I tried to explain to him that I'm not the last person that's going to ask about this now. I know in your mind, maybe I am, but I'm not. Right. And his response to me was, I can talk about it. Like, I want to talk about it. Hiding it is the part that was killing him. Wasting energy on trying to pretend like everything was all right was the part that was ruining everything in his life. And that's what was making it so difficult. I still didn't quite understand, if I'm being honest with you, what he was hoping to accomplish with that interview. In retrospect, you pointed it out, like, he goes on to win in Houston and plays solid golf and everyone seems to embrace him now. And it's still a struggle. I spoke with him in Hilton Head about it again. And I spoke with him at the PGA Championship about it. It is a process. Like, he still gets what he calls episodes on the golf course. If you know anything about PTSD, and I know a little bit because I had a lot of friends in the Marines that went to the first Gulf War. And they've spoken with me about how difficult it is coming back home and being in a situation, being in a crowd, which that's all a PGA Tour player does. I mean, that's essentially is the job description, is walking in a crowd, and how difficult that is, because you always sort of get these triggering moments of if you see catch someone's walking up behind you out of the corner of your eye. And the fact that it continues to happen at tournaments to Gary, and he continues to do what he wants to do for a living. I mean, I don't want to say someone is brave, because I feel like that's dismissive. Being involved, you and I both, being involved with the Folds of Honor and meeting true heroes, you sort of realize that, yeah, we use it too easily in sports, and we probably need to watch the way we use it. I would argue that what he's going through is truly heroic.
Okay, final question. I really appreciate your time, Rex Hoggard. It's a question I ask all of our guests. If you could have a dream foursome, if you could have three others you could play sort of a magical round of golf with, and those three, they could still be with us, or maybe they've passed on. Who would those three be? And where would you go play a very cool round of golf with those three individuals?
Well, it's got to be my son, because I always play the rounds I enjoy the most are with Cole, my son. So he's got to be on that list too. But I mentioned Jeff Babineau and Jeff Rude, and some of the most enjoyable rounds of golf I've had is with those two when I was at Golf Week magazine. And where is easy? It'd be Royal Dornoch. I think those two introduced me to that golf course. It's in way north in Scotland. You got to go really out of your way to get there. But it's one of those truly magical places. And it's kind of a 1A and 1B for me now, because I've fallen in love with North Bear, which is in the south of Scotland. But yeah, it would be those three people on that course.
Hey, Rex, if I could be the fifth in your group, that would make for a very special round of golf. Thanks so much to Rex Hoggard for joining us here on Musings on Golf as we covered the 108th PGA Championship. Next week, Bobby Clampett. Bobby won on the PGA Tour after a stellar collegiate career, spent decades in the broadcast booth, and then he invented impact zone golf. And we will hear all kinds of great tales from Bobby Clampett on Musings on Golf. Hope golf is part of your Memorial Day weekend. For Jenna Self, our executive producer, Kelly Elbin, signing off and thanking you once again for joining us on Musings on Golf.